Thank you, DA. Good evening. We're going to start off with a question tonight, maybe two questions. I want you to think about them before you answer them, because I'm going to have to ask for a show of hands. How many are there of you that are creatures of habit? I'm real glad to see everybody raise your hand except Cynthia. How many of you are used to customs? Thank you, Cynthia. That's part of us. That's part of the history of the world. That's part of the history of the Bible and the Book of Mormon. That's one of the things that drives us as individuals and as groups more than anything else is our customs and our habits. That is what caused a lot of strife in the scriptures, was customs and habits. When all of this started, of course you had Adam and Eve. Didn't take them long to pick the fruit and eat it. Get in trouble. And it all went downhill from there. We all know that. We know that story. And then it went from there. Now back then, there was a lot of things that were perfect that we don't run into today. There was no gene pool. There really weren't any germs because there was only two people. And there was a lot of things that came about as a result of the increase in the population. You know, people, if you look in the scriptures, lived a whole lot longer then than they do now. It's because they didn't have all of the stuff that we as a crowded, populated country has to deal with, hygienically, sanitarily, whatever you want to call it. Microbially, I guess that's the word. So it was pretty simple. And we know that man was given to know the difference between good and evil right off the bat. The thing that strikes me about that is that God didn't see that evil was destroyed. He could have destroyed it to begin with, but he didn't. Because in his wisdom and in his knowledge of things to come, he knew that that would be an integral part of our lives, would be the ability to choose between good and evil, between right and wrong, between whatever else you want to call those two words. And it shows all throughout the scriptures that people chose good, people chose evil. It was because of jealousy that Joseph went to Egypt. The more I read about things like that and the history of what happened in Egypt, the more I'm of the opinion that that was a good thing, their jealousy, because the 430 years that the Israelites spent in Egypt, which is longer than white men have been on this continent, give that time span and what's happened with us, stick that back there for 430 years. There's a lot of things that the Israelites learned that did us good today. One of them is this. But there was always evil present, as there always is. And it took a lot of persuading the children of Israel to abandon the customs and the habits that they had back then and get out of there. And they weren't probably sure why, because, and I'm saying it that way, because look at their actions and decisions that they made while they were wandering 40 years in the desert. Some of it was right, some of it was wrong. But they lived. A lot of them. If you look at Numbers and at the first military draft, you'll see that there was probably around 3 million that come out of there. That's almost as many as in the Kansas City metropolitan area today. So that's the amount of people that Moses had to deal with when he got out of Egypt. With all of the things the 3 million people think up. Some of it was custom that they wanted to go back to. Some of it was just habit. Some of it was choices because of the lack of customs or habit that they missed. There are just all kinds of things that 3 million people can come up with. But he had to manage it with God's help, and he did. He wrote down the first five books of the Old Testament, as we understand, using the technology that he got from Egypt. So that's to our benefit. But it went on. And we get to Noah. And all of the things that God saw was going on with Noah. Well, not just so much Noah, but the civilization that was there with Noah. Talks about giants there. Well, in my Bible and in what I've been able to find, a giant back then was a bully. Didn't have anything to do with size. It just had to do that he was a bully or a tyrant. It's behavioral instead of size. And that they were marrying people of the world. Our people were marrying people of the world, and it was tainting them, just like it says in two or three other instances in the Old Testament, where God forbade the children of Israel to intermingle with other civilizations, I guess you'd say. Went back and forth. We all know all those stories. You get to Abraham, or Abram, and Sarai, and you start all over again. You see, the moon god that was the predominant god in Mesopotamia, or Ur, was sin. In history, there's all kinds of history that can tell you that. You can look on the internet, you can look several places. And what he did is exactly what is sin in our Bible. And they worshiped him because of that. And that was their religion, that was their custom, that became their habit. And as you know, and as I know, habits are hard to break. And customs are hard to abandon instantly unless you really have something extraordinary to convince you. Just like when Abraham couldn't have a daughter or a son with Sarai. So what'd he do? It was the custom of Sin, the moon god, that he could take the handmaiden, or she would give him the handmaiden and have, and he had Ishmael. And God didn't cause a miscarriage there. He let Ishmael be born. Consequence. As it tells you in the 16th chapter of Genesis, the angel of the Lord told Hagar that he would be a wild man, and that every man's hand would be against him, and his hand would be against every man's. And it still is today. Because if you look in the Quran, Abraham did not put Isaac on the altar. Abraham put Ishmael on the altar. And they recognized Ishmael as the first son of Abraham, the eldest. And we all know where the Islamists have gone to today with ISIS and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram. And you can just go on and look at how those people think. And that's their belief. That's their custom. They think they're right. And maybe according to the way they read their scriptures, they may be right. I doubt it, because I think there's a little bit more Satan got plowed into it. But we've been getting grief off of that ever since. Off of that mistake or off of that custom that Sarai and Abraham did because of sin. That's not the only thing that's far-reaching in the way of the wages of sin, I guess you'd say. We can go on and on for several I could go on for quite a while on the things that were done back then that, well, Adam and Eve and the apple, for one thing, if you want to call it an apple fruit. Look at the results of that. So just because it's something that seems incidental at the time, according to God's plan, it's not. And we have to understand the principle of that. What we think is incidental, what we think is, we rationalize something away to where we want to make it right when it's not, or whatever, there are consequences, and consequences go from generation to generation. That's my point. This goes on all the way through the Old Testament. There's a couple of places in the Old Testament, well, there's one place especially in the Old Testament. There in Isaiah where it's, of course, it's prophesied that there'll be a son born of a virgin and his name will be Emmanuel. In other words, God with us. And that's significant because up to that point, up to the time he was born, people were afraid of God because of what happened when Moses went up to get the Ten Commandments and all of the stuff about don't go up on the mountain and all of this. So when you get through, I guess you say the development of civilization from the beginning, so I'm going to say to the end of Malachi, it's pretty well set. And then you enter a period of time between Malachi and Matthew, which is about 300 years, and to give you an idea of what 300 years is, that's longer than this country's been organized. And again, you can look at the changes we've had here. You can look at the changes in between Malachi and Matthew, and they're similar. Things have gotten pretty organized, I guess you'd say. Things are starting to fall into place the wrong way. Because one of the things the Jews did when they started getting the law from Moses, they started misinterpreting it. They started reading it wrong. And I don't know whether it was something that was on purpose or whether it was something that was accidental. But the upshot of it was that they didn't look at the meaning of the law. They looked at the letter of the law and they started imitating it. Example, it's in Deuteronomy. Sixth chapter, I've read this a dozen times. I'm going to start with verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. Now, where'd you hear that verse before? See, that's one of the two great commandments. The neighbor as thyself is Leviticus 19:18. The point being, God or Jesus Christ didn't invent it. He was reciting the Old Testament. He always has recited the Old Testament. Go look at the Sermon on the Mount and look at all the times that he recited that there. Because he wasn't creating anything new. He was creating new ideas because of their customs that they acquired. But he really was restoring the gospel as it was intended to be in the first of the Old Testament. Anyway, love the God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. They totally missed verse 6. I don't know, maybe they totally ignored it, I don't know, but they sure missed it. Because this is one of two scriptures that they now put in a phylactery and tied on their forehead. And by going through three pages in the internet, that shows you what to do with a phylactery, how to make it, and tie it up there, it's a big deal. The last phylactery I saw was in the National Geographic, and it was a young Jew in Israel with an acrylic haircut, sunglasses, and he had a band across his head like this. It was chrome, spring steel, with a computer chip right here. And it contained the verses that are in their regular phylacteries. And that was their belief. That was the custom that they'd acquired. And they still do it today. And that is not what that passage tells me. And it's little things like that that have consequences. It's little things that you miss or maybe you want to ignore or whatever the reason is that you leave out of some kind of a scripture or take it wrong that has consequences. And it has consequences for millennia, really, if it really takes hold. But the other thing that does is it creates an attitude. I think I've told you here, as I've said in a couple of places before, I used to work with a man that his parents were Orthodox Jews. And we got to talking one time when I felt that I could talk to him about things like this. And I said, well, what are your beliefs? He said, we don't have beliefs. We have practices. And I said, well, we have beliefs. He says, well, why would you want beliefs? You have to have practices. You have to do things. They miss the point of putting it in their heart, which to me is fatal, really. When it comes down to the gospel as we understand it, it's something you put in your heart. Well, you don't put it in your heart. Back then, the heart, since you had all these, sensations of glee and sorrow and being scared, that's what they felt was this sensation here. They had no clue that this bunch of gray matter up here had anything to do with anything. Matter of fact, the Egyptians, when they mummified somebody, they just took all that out and threw it away because they considered it useless. So it was everything was your heart, see, because that's where you always felt. The growing within your breast, I think, is the way that it's mentioned in the Book of Mormon, but it's the same thing. So everything's of the heart. So in these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. Nope, that's not part of our custom now. That's not part of our belief. That's not part of anything. It's all external, and we don't have to have a feeling for anything just so you do it. And if you do it correctly, then you're religious. But that leaves out a whole bunch of things that Christianity says is very important. Repentance, charity, attitude, benevolence, generosity, being a peacemaker. None of those things exist when it's not in your heart. They only exist as an instruction or something. Maybe more on that later. But for thousands of years, they went with this process, I guess you'd say. Everything that they did, they got a rule. Each generation of rabbis went from this set of rules. They would always improve it to this. It was always improved to this. It was always improved to this for thousands of years. But it was down the same wrong path. And we know that now. We're aware of that now. But what are the ramifications of that now? What is it that you have to contend with in this life that when they made that decision back then to go this path that you have to contend with now? I could have a preacher up here every hour for a week to explain that. Of course, you get to Isaiah when the prophecy of Jesus Christ is coming. And then you get to the New Testament. And when you get to the New Testament, which is thousands of years before for thousands of years from the beginning of time, I guess you'd say, everything changes. There was one little thing. See, Malachi. Thank you. In between Malachi and Matthew is another 300 years. There's a lot went on in those 300 years. One of the most, I guess you'd say, it wasn't impressive, scariest things, disastrous things was William the Conqueror. No. Alexander the Great conquered the world as they knew it then. And the method was a standard operating procedure back then. You conquered a city or you conquered a country, and then you took all the royalty and you killed them or you blinded them, and you burned all of their books, you burned all of the stuff that was royal, I guess you'd say, including all the educational supplies or whatever there was that would identify them as a country. And then the Greek stuff was brought in because he was real high on the Greek civilization. And he did that as he went down through the Mideast, but when he got to Israel, he did something different. He didn't kill everybody. He didn't do all that stuff. And when an overpowering force comes in and takes you, and you're convinced that he's going to kill you, and then he doesn't, human nature, and it's human nature, pretty soon you start thinking the way he thinks, just as a matter of survival. And in the New Testament, those Jews that did that are called Grecians because they were adopting the Greek way of life. And there was a group that decided not to do that. And they were going to stay with the Mosaic Law, of course. And boy, did they get pressure from the rest of the Israelites. You can't do that. You're going to get us killed. What's the matter with you? Quit doing all that Mosaic Law stuff. And the pressure was on. Well, there's one thing that you and I both do, and everybody's done from the beginning of time, when you get that kind of pressure, but you get that kind of a principle in mind that you're going to be whole. You bear down on what you believe. And you bear down, and the more the pressure, the more you bear down, and pretty soon that turns into tunnel vision. And you're thinking nothing of this is right and I'm going to do this, and you forget everything else around you. But you are going to survive, and this is going to survive with you. When I was working, one of the things we did when we developed the curriculum for call takers and dispatchers, we gave them a flip chart. And if the caller was extremely panicky or extremely hostile or whatever, and it got them to where they couldn't think, they went to the flip chart. And they was categorized. You just go to whatever applied, and then you ask those questions because they would have tunnel vision so bad they couldn't think of the questions or the things to say to those people, and it worked. So that kind of thing even still works today. But it really worked with that group called the Pharisees, or separated ones in Hebrew. And they outlasted Alexander the Great. And when they did, and his empire fell apart, guess who the heroes were in Israel? The Pharisees. Because they had preserved the Mosaic Law. Now they were the heroes. Now they were the religious foundation of their country. They were revered, they were looked up to, and all of the things that you want to say about them being great. And they were the authority. And that's what Jesus Christ walked into, knowing this. But they were still doing the ritualistic stuff instead of the stuff from the heart. And everybody believed, since they had brought them out of that mess, those people really believed, it is our belief that you have to do all this, all these rituals. And I think they said, the last I read on rules for that, there's 200 books. Of rules. And you got to do all of them to be religious. But you don't have to believe any of it. It's not of the heart. So that's what Jesus Christ runs into. There was a list of things that he did in the Beatitudes. There's a list of things that he covered in the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. But if you want to break it down into the difference between the Mosaic Law and the Gospel of Jesus Christ, you can have about seven things that you can compare. Under the law, there was no murder. That means you couldn't kill anybody. But boy, did that leave the door open for all other kinds of things that you could do. Under Christ, there was no anger, which was a lot harder to handle, and it wasn't my custom to do that. No adultery. Here again, nothing of the heart. You just didn't commit adultery. Under Christ, no lust. We know these things. No divorce, commitment. No oath taking, speak the truth. No retaliation, forgiveness. Hatred for your enemy, love your enemy. Everybody that was used to doing these other things under the law for thousands and thousands of years had to change the way they looked at those things. And there was the rub, because sin was still as dominant as anything. And when you quit being angry, and when you quit being lustful, and when you have commitment, and you speak the truth, and you forgive people, to this day, according to what I've read, if a rabbi, and this particular rabbi, this was back in the 40s, I think it was, went to the outdoor outhouse to use the facilities, and his friend, as a joke, tipped it over. And he knew it was his friend, so when he got everything squared away and everything, he forgave him. And the other rabbis really let into him, because you can't forgive people. You have to have revenge. So you couldn't even do it to your friends. That's the mindset that we find hard to grasp, is that kind of stuff. We have been raised in a country that's been Christian-oriented, and we have raised ourselves. We have grown up under those customs and rules and laws and practices, and we really don't get the impact of how different that is from the rest of the world. I can sit in a Sunday school class and listen to a whole lot of things about love and peace and joy and all of that, and it's true. What I hear is true. But what does it carry compared to what the rest, what does it carry to what ISIS does? How do you get people to understand that there's more of a value to what we believe than what they believe? You got to talk about it. And you can't just get up with a bunch of rhetorical phrases and say, well, you got to love God, which is true, but well, you got to love God and you got to be nice and you don't hit and you got to forgive people. That doesn't mean anything to them. Doesn't mean to a lot of people that aren't ISIS. Doesn't mean anything to people that don't have any idea what a religion is. And there's a lot of them in this country, surprisingly enough. We got a couple in church that when their kids were in high school, they used to participate in the student exchange program. You know, they'd have a teenager from somewhere else come and live with them for a year, and one of their sons or daughters would go live in that country. And they had this one girl that came and lived with them for a year. She was from South America. I won't tell you the country, but it's a big South American country. They had a good time, and she learned a lot, and they learned a lot, you know, as usually the case is. And she goes back home, and the mother and her keep corresponding. And finally, this girl writes and says, you know, one of the things that always surprised me the most about the United States was everybody says please and thank you, and they hold the door open for somebody even when they don't know them. He said, we don't do that here. He said, that was just as foreign as I could ever get. I never got used to having somebody hold a door open for me or say thank you to me. He says, I didn't know what to do. How common is that to us? It's a knee-jerk reaction to us. And if you really think about the last time or the last four or five times that somebody held a door open for you, or somebody, you held a door open for somebody, there was a feeling of peace there. There was a feeling of some friendship there, even though you didn't know the guy. And they don't have that. That's not a piece of the fabric of their society there. So what else is missing from that society? Well, it happens to be the one that has the highest kidnapping rate in the world. If you live in one of their big cities down there and you have any money at all, you contract or buy a helicopter to get you to and from work because you don't dare drive the streets. Because kidnapping's down there for ransom is like running stop signs up here. I know it's bad here. It ain't that bad. There's another country down there. Had a lot of drug problems. But the other thing they had was a lot of orphan problems. And they had a lot of kids, and I'm talking from 4 and 5 years old on up to early teenagers, early adults, 1920, were homeless, streetless, without any hope, without any parents, without any leadership, and they banded together. This is awful. This is really awful. And they lived in the sewers in this city. And the sewers had benches built up on both sides of the underground conduits. Nobody knows why, or there wasn't explained why. But at night, that's where these kids lived. They'd climb down in these sewers and sleep on these benches. Kids from 5 clear up to 20 or 21, 22 years old. Thousands of them. So when the thieving and the stealing and all of that stuff got too bad in a particular neighborhood, the police would come in there about 2 in the morning and open up these 2 manholes and pour about 10 gallons of gas in there and light it. The police would do that to get rid of the problem. How would you like to live in a country that thinks that's okay? My stomach turns every time I think about that. This is a country that is based on the Bible, and actually based on the Book of Mormon, but its roots was in the Bible. And you can go through our amendments, you can go through our constitutions, you can go through our laws, you can go through our practices about our laws, and you can find every bit of that in the scriptures. And you can find it in all the practices that were laid down by Moses in the Old Testament. It's there, even down to probable cause, even down to cooperation, even all the stuff that has to do with all the warts that we have, and we have a lot of warts, every country always has, but with all of the things that we have to deal with, everything that's in there, you can point out a place in the Bible where it says to do that. We have grown up under that. We are used to that. We tend to take it for granted because it's always been a part of our habits and our customs and our beliefs. And we can't imagine going down here to this country and thinking it's okay to pour gas down 2 manhole covers. But they think it's okay. Because they haven't been taught this. I guess it scared this one girl to death the first time somebody opened the door for her. They didn't know what they were going to do to her next. It's kind of sad. When it was an act of kindness or manners. You get back to this thing about tunnel vision. That was the way man acts. That's the way we act today. In public service or in public safety, we train for it. They honestly train to keep you, when you're in a bad situation, from getting tunnel vision. Or they know you can't help but do that, so they teach you to react to it correctly. It's been a part of the curriculum now for decades. A lot of people don't know that. You know, that's what scares me about this right to carry. I'm all for right to carry. I'm all for nobody taking my guns away from me. But boy, they sure ought to teach those people how to use them. And they ought to teach them every year, because if you don't, and we've already had it, we're going to have a lot of people killed that are innocent. And some of them have been shot by police because they didn't know that they were the good guy or the bad guy, because they come bailing in with a gun in their hand. And the lawyers will have a heyday when it comes to lawsuits. We have a long way to go in a lot of those things. But so with all of the ways that I have talked about that the world has grown and the world has progressed, then what do you do about it? What's the mirror image of that? Well, quite simply, it's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I talked about the things that were under the gospel instead of under the law, you know, like no hate and all of that kind of stuff. You know, if I'm in a hurry and I'm trying to get a point across, I tell people, you know, don't hit, share, and be nice. And that pretty well covers everything. But that don't hit, share, and be nice is this whole book and this whole book on how to do that. I think the things that really impressed me here a couple of weeks ago, we were in Sunday school class here. We were looking at Ephesians. I assume that we're all there it is. That we're all familiar with Ephesians and Galatians and Colossians and all of those things in the New Testament. And you know, there's a lot of good information in those things about how to think, how to get your mind right, and because you get your mind right, how you make the right decisions on things, because you make the right judgments, and then things come out better. And that's what that boils down to. And people did not know that before Jesus Christ came. That's the scary part about this. The thousands and thousands of years of the world went by, and they were taught it. Yeah, they were taught it back here. And they put it in phylacteries, and they put it in external stuff, and they totally missed it. And they grew up without that idea. And we take it for granted. We know it. It's a knee-jerk reaction. It's a part of our makeup to do this. And therefore, we take it for granted to one degree or other, every one of us. So you got people like Paul and the other apostles. It's their job to go out and change this. And you know how that goes. Change. I know how change goes. When I was a sergeant, they put me upstairs in administration, and they said, here's all these things to fill out for computerization of the department. Figure out what they are and fill them out, and we're going to put up a computer system and you do it. I didn't even like computers. In fact, they almost had to hold a gun on me the first time to put my hands on a keyboard. And I hated computers when I retired. And then somebody bought me a laptop for a retirement present. And I still can't get away from them. But what that did was, it was different. It was a change. It took away a lot of individuality, but it gave everybody a chance to get everything in the way of information. And out of the approximately 12 captains that were up there in charge of the department, 10 of them hated my guts because I was doing this. And they, as captains, did everything they could under the sun to me as a sergeant to make my life absolutely, completely, totally miserable while I was doing this. And I did it because it needed to be done. That was when I started taking nerve pills. I still take nerve pills. I find out. But I even got down into the part to where I was getting tunnel vision on things, and I had to spread out and be a little more circumspect about stuff. And the only thing that really kept me going and kept my sanity for what I had there for a while was prayer. The same thing we talk about. And boy, I mean, it was some pretty sincere prayer. But I didn't have near the problem that Paul had. If the history books that I read are correct, Paul knew he had to go to Rome. Paul went to Rome because he said he was a Roman. And he gets to Rome and he ends up in jail. Well, he ends up in prison. And from what I've read, he was put in the Matertine. The Matertine was an underground prison. It was a dungeon. I've been in a couple of penitentiaries around here as a visitor. They got lights, they got heat, they got running water, they've got medical capabilities, they've got a bunch of stuff, you know. And none of those prisons back then had any of that, especially the sanitary facilities. How would you like to spend a few years down in a dungeon with a few hundred other people with no sanitary facilities? I don't think it'd be very easy on your peace of mind. And especially since you knew that you were never going to get out of there alive, that you were going to die there. You know, it'd be real easy under those circumstances to get tunnel vision and to try to stay alive by some method or manner that's man's. But Paul had the Spirit of the Holy Ghost with him. And his frame of mind, to start off with, where I got this was, my Bible's a Nelson Study Bible. So is Warren's, right? But at the front of each book, it's got some commentary about the book. Authorship, destination, the recipients of it, you know, who it was written to, especially in the Pauline letters, the occasion for why it was written, the purpose, and the theme. And it's like anything else, it's not scriptural, but it's information, and you take it with a grain of salt if you need to. But while Paul was in prison, he wrote Ephesians and Colossians. And we discussed this a little bit 2 weeks ago in Sunday school class. And when I finally got it through my head that those two books were written under those kind of circumstances by a man that had no hope of ever getting out, you know, that really shocked me. Do you know how much, now you ministry, You have an idea of how much you prepare for a sermon. And you know usually the atmosphere that you like to have while you're preparing for a sermon. I like quiet. I like a little peace and tranquility. I don't like to be interrupted. How'd you like to prepare your sermons in prison under those circumstances back then? And you can tell by the way that those books are written that there was no tunnel vision. And that he was answering things in such a way that we're still learning off of his writings today. Now you take that with the content of these books and you compare them against the doctrine of Isis. They're not even in the same solar system. We have a big movement on in this country, regrettably. It's called Rejecting Organized Religion. I think only 48% of the country says that they believe in organized religion anymore, and I think that's about 6 months old, that information. Might be more or less now, I don't know, but it's less than half. How did it get that way? Probably if you ask 100 people, you'd get 100 different answers. And probably each one of them got some truth to it. But what do I do to what do I do to contribute to that? How many kids leave our church? How many people leave our church? What have I done to slow that tide down? I can't run up to Jesse's family and harangue them and chastise them, or I can't even do it to Jesse and beat him over the head and convince his kid that when they're 17 years old, they're going to stay in the church. I can't do that. That's silly. But what do I do to prevent that? You got to tell them the difference. They got to know the difference between what I've been talking about, what's good and what's evil, instead of that's good and that's evil. That's good, that's bad. Because I'll guarantee if you got five little ones out of here and you ask them what's bad, they'll give you five different answers. Someone's going to be pretty right, some may not be. So what is we as parents and grandparents and people that are aunts and uncles that kids look up to, what are we doing about that? What I see a lot of is, well, I ran into a situation, and we're not this bad, but I ran into a situation here a few years ago where we had two young couples with kids. And as I'm getting ready to go to visit them, I'm getting emails from one of the guys that they have these two young elders from another church, I'll leave it at that, that have been visiting him, and they've got all of these doctrinal things, and they're arguing it up, and they're building a case why he should join their church, and he doesn't have any of the answers, so, and he's got so many of them, and he's getting pretty scattered, so I finally tell him, I said, well, just wait till I get there. We'll see what we can do. So we have dinner. We got all set up in the living room. Now, these guys don't have any other contact with church except an elder once a month, usually for one to maybe two nights. We that travel know how this goes. So here come these two young elders, and they sit down, and we get all our introductions and everything, and they sit down over here, and the other two couples, they sit over here, and Martha sits over here. We have an opening prayer. Apparently I'm in charge. They let me do the opening prayer. We sat there for a little bit. One of the young husbands, he makes some kind of a silly, lame question. I give him a silly, lame answer. We're not getting anywhere. We're not even talking. And we're all sitting there, and finally it dawns on me, you know, I didn't come all the way over here to sit here and do this. I come over here to help feed these people. and I'm going to do it. So I says, you know, I got a question for you two young couples. I says, you've got a bunch of little kids. I says, and I'm pretty sure you believe in Jesus Christ. So what are you going to do to teach your kids that there's a value in believing in Jesus Christ? Enough that it'll keep them to where they're young adults. They just erupted. We went on for an hour and a half, 2 hours, looking up scriptures, talking about this, discarding that, coming up with another idea. And those two elders just sit there. They never said a word. I got looked at. Boy, did I get looked at. But they never could offer a thing because all they knew was their church's doctrine. And they knew nothing about the workings of religion and how it's supposed to affect your life, or at least they hadn't been programmed to talk about it. My guess is that neither one of them was 25, so they probably didn't know a thing about family life. And we had a very good, long meeting. I don't know. I know it was over an hour and a half. We all get up. They look daggers at me, shake my hand, and leave. And that's the last time they showed up, I understand. But those two couples got something out of that meeting. And they were doing it next time I went out there. But what are we doing to show our kids or convince our kids that there's a value in believing in Jesus Christ as opposed to letting the world tell us what it is? We got Sunday school classes. Every Sunday we get little kids up here. I think it's great. And I sit and listen to them. And boy, they're dead on as far as I'm concerned. But what happens when they're 10, 12, 14, 15 years old? And they start listening to what's over the fence, I guess you'd say. And how are they handling it? And how are we handling that? We've got a young married, I think we've got a young married couple's Sunday school class. I don't know whether it's husband and wives or just guys or what it is. What are they talking about? What are they studying? Are they planning on what everybody can do to help the kids when they're 14 and 15 and 16 not get discouraged with this church because of outside influence? They know what it's like. I know what it's like. I'd much rather have the ounce of prevention than the pound of cure. And I don't know what it is because every kid's different. The parents know what it is. If they pay attention to their kids or the grandparents, especially the parents, they know what it is that their kids are thinking. They know what it is that how their kids are reacting to things. I'll give you an example. And this is going to come up. It's going to come up again. We have a man that's a member of a satanic cult. And I know that because his website starts with "Hail Satan." And he's a professor at the University of Minnesota. And he has put out, and the news has picked it up. This is the second time he's done it. The last time he did it was in 2012. But this year, several news organizations picked it up. And he's saying that with this Me Too movement that's going on now, and I think we all know what the Me Too movement is, that the Virgin Mary was a victim of that. And that she was taken advantage of. And that was one of the worst things that you could happen to a young girl. And he's making hay out of it. Now, how do you handle that? He's already got a bunch of backlash from it. He's already got the easy one, which is in Luke. Luke No, is it in Luke? Well, I thought it was in Luke. Maybe I'm getting it wrong here.
First chapter
of Luke. Is it verse 6? Nope. That's about Elizabeth. You go on down to 12 of Zechariah.
Verse 26.
No, it's verse 38. It's on the first chapter of Luke, but it's verse 38. The angel of the Lord has talked to Mary. They've got done with this. And Mary said, "Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto thee, me accordingly to the word." And the angel departed from her. That's permission. So he comes back with, yeah, but she was being unduly influenced by a higher power, and he had power over her, and so that makes him a bad guy. This is what the Satanist is putting out. And he's a professor, so he's teaching college students. Well, see, there just happens to be one big problem with all of his story. And it's a criminal thing that I worked with for 30-some years. It's called intent. What was the intent of the Holy Ghost? What was the intent of Gabriel? What was the intent of God? What was the intent of Mary? What was the intent of talking to Joseph? What was the intent? When you look at a warrant, it said they did thus and thus and thus with the intent of. And there's no intent there that would match me to at all. But you have to know this, so when your kids in 2 or 3 years come to you, you can answer that instead of, let's go talk to so-and-so. The world's full of people like this, and the world's full of that kind of filth, really, and that's what it is filth. And we have to look at these things and understand them, and especially you young married couples with kids need to get out in front of this, and as groups, it'd be a good Sunday school class. How do you handle this stuff, see? How do you handle this stuff that your kids are coming up with? They're going to come up with, because you all know what's coming up in schools better than I do. And I already know that some of you don't like it. And I don't blame you. So how do you give them, your kids, how do you convince them that there's worth to believing in Jesus Christ and sticking with him? Your Sunday school teachers are doing a good job with the little bitty ones. They're right where they're supposed to be from what I hear. What about when they get this big? When they start thinking for themselves? I don't have that answer except you get ahead of it. And you get ahead of it by figuring out what you need to do to answer the thing that they're going to come up with. I got 2 grandsons that gave me a heads up on this when they were about this big. One of them sitting right there. Don't turn around. Grandpa, what's the difference between a blessing and luck? So what's the difference between blessing and luck? Remember that, Cody?
You never gave me the answer.
Because I didn't have an answer. The way you look at it. It's how you consider those things. And how much you want to acknowledge God or how much you want to deny God, so it's a blessing or luck. If you give our kids an understanding of what's right and wrong, and you can start clear back here or clear back here in the front of these books, and you can get all kinds of examples of what's right and what's wrong, and you start in ahead of time, and like I said, my favorite phrase there is to get ahead of it. Have a plan when it comes. Our success ratio will be a lot better than it is now. My mom, bless her heart, and you know the rules behind that. You can say anything about anybody you want as long as you bless their heart first. That's what they tell me down south. She'd say, well, that's none of your business, or that's just bad, or, well, they'll tell you that later, because she didn't know. See, I'm not faulting her for that. She did the best she could. But with all of the stuff that's coming on, and especially dirt like this guy from Minnesota, we need to get ahead of some of that stuff, and we need to have some answers ready, and we need to have some mentally prepared stuff so I don't stand there with my mouth open when a grandson says, what's the difference between blessing and luck? And that's what I did. I stood there with my mouth open because I didn't expect it. And I can't do it by myself. And there isn't any one or two or three of you out there that can do it as a group of one or two or three. It's all of us. And we have to be in communication, and we have to know what's going on, and we have to be informed, and we have to come. Actually, the internet is surprisingly pretty helpful on stuff like this. Other people's ideas about what it is and what you do, you take that idea and you look in the Bible to see how valid it is. And if it is, and it's in there two or three places, use it. What's your value that you have that Jesus Christ is worth listening to and following? What's your value? Make that your habit of answering that. Thank you.